From the Medicus Podcast, my name is Griffin Johnson. For those unfamiliar with the medical education system, the learning in medicine does not stop with graduation from medical school. Those who aim to work in clinical medicine usually attend a medical residency program lasting from 3 to 7 years in order to finish the program as a physician eligible to obtain a specialty board certification. Some physicians follow their residency with a fellowship as they subspecialize into an even narrower field of practice. The medical resident, a position within the hospital teaching hierarchy developed by Dr. William Stuart Halsted, was initially designed as a live-in position, hence the name of those junior doctors, residents. Today, the residency program serves as both a necessary training step required for the practice of specialty medicine, while also being something that, despite controversy, is generally looked at as a positive for a hospital system's bottom line. This puts residents in a tough position. They can find themselves feeling financially unfulfilled, working as much as 80 hours per week for an average first-year resident salary in the $60,000 per year range, while also knowing that this period of their lives is required to later practice in their specialty of choice. Recently, it has become more clear that what should be a symbiotic relationship between residents and their hospital training programs is beginning to look a little more one-sided. With this, more training programs have begun forming labor unions in order to improve their working conditions, benefits, and pay. House staff at the University of Illinois unionized in 2021, the University of Pennsylvania in May of 2023, and Massachusetts General Hospital in June of 2023. Many of these votes received public attention, considering the immense size and prestige of some of these training programs. With the impact of recent strikes like those of the United Auto Workers, the Writers Guild of America, and the Screen Actors Guild late last year, we are entering an era of increased emphasis on the power of collective bargaining. And that emphasis has emerged in graduate medical education. This transition adds yet another element for fourth-year medical students to consider when applying to, interviewing at, and ranking the programs that they may be training at. To explore these recent votes for unionization, I spoke with Dr. Josh Neff, a psychiatrist based in San Francisco. Dr. Neff graduated from the University of California San Francisco School of Medicine, then completed his psychiatry residency at UCSF as well. He previously served as the regional vice president for Northern California at the Committee of Interns and Residents, or CIR, the largest union of medical residents and fellows in the United States, and he is now the member liaison for physician organizing there. Dr. Neff, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So just to start things off, can you explain your role as the member liaison for physician organizing at the CIR?
I can, at least to the extent we figured out what it is. The inspiration for the role is coming from a lot of unions have what's called a member organizer program in which people who are members of the union, so for instance, if it was, let's say, custodial staff in a hospital or in a union, then for a period of time, that person who normally works among the custodial staff would have a period of time where they work as an organizer, but with the same salary and benefits and everything, but for a period of time, they're functionally union staff. And so, you know, that's a really important and valuable model because we can talk more about the idea of a member-led union, but you want members leading the union. And so this allows, you know, us to be really involved in the day-to-day functioning. And also we're generally effective organizers because we are part of the group that we are trying to help organize. In terms of the particulars of what I'll be doing in this role, and I should also mention that because as residents, we can't take time off during the midst of residency to work as an organizer. The adaptation we're trying out here in this, I'm kind of the pilot case of this, at CIR is we'll have recent graduates from training who were CIR members working half-time in this member liaison role and then half-time doing clinical work in order to continue to practice after finishing training. In terms of the particulars of what I'm doing in this role, we're trying to figure out how exactly I, as a physician post-residency who's also a member of the staff, can be most helpful. Some of the projects that it looks like I'm going to be involved in as I get started here are helping us to develop an alumni program, also supporting medical student organizing efforts. So, of course, medical students can't organize as a union as such. but were interested in thinking about ways that they could use labor organizing strategies and so forth to address concerns they have and potentially also support resident and other kinds of labor organizing efforts around the country. And I was going to mention one other thing, but it's slipping my mind. I'll mention it if it comes up later.
Yeah, no problem. It sounds like right now this is a pretty new position for you, but it also sounds like a broad position in that there's a lot of things that you could end up doing. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it's accurate. It's very accurate.
And then just to kind of sum it up, it sounds also like what you were explaining is if you're a resident, right, you struggle necessarily to take extra time to really work on the organizing efforts of forming a union. And you, as someone who is working at the CIR now, you're capable of taking that extra time to sort of act as a middle person between the residents and the CIR, or is that along the right lines?
Yeah, it's heading in the right direction. Okay. For sure. I think what I want to emphasize in answering this last question of yours is that really the CIR functions because of current residents and fellows who are leaders. And so that's, you know, I was one of those people who, as a resident, so I finished residency this past June. As a resident, I was extremely involved. And so we have a lot of really dedicated people who are the core of the union running and being strong day to day. And we also have an incredible staff of organizers at different hospitals. You know, as I think you're getting at, residents are incredibly famously busy, right? And, mm-hmm. You know, the 80-hour work weeks, et cetera. Also, there's a lot of turnover. We have lots of members who, after 3 years, finish residency and move on to other things or go to fellowship at a place where CIR isn't yet, and so forth. So this just to say, organizers play a really important role. And then we also have a number of other staff members that allow the union to function in important ways. You know, we have legal staff and so on and so forth, things that allow us to be successful in the various efforts we undertake. But something I want to really emphasize throughout our conversation is that in the case of CIR, the residents and fellows who are members are the union. And then we have a set of staff who support us in doing what we do. So, to come back to your most recent question, it is what you say in that I, as someone who was involved as a member, now have more time to kind of take some projects further and do some things that there wouldn't be time to do, or there wasn't time for someone like me to do when I was also working as house staff full-time at the same time. So yeah, I don't know if, does that speak to your
absolutely.
Question?
And then we were talking before we started recording, you were mentioning that you don't really think too many people know what, you know, a regional vice president at the CIR would do. And so could you kind of elucidate what that entails as well, in that what was your previous role as a resident and as a regional vice president for Northern California? What was that like?
Yeah, so CIR is a deeply democratic institution. In fact, by law, all unions are very democratic in this country. And I think that's true in most other countries as well. But in our case, the representative structure works as there's one delegate on average per 100 members. And then there's one regional vice president per on average 1,000 members. So for instance, I was at UCSF. There are about 1,600 house staff at UCSF. So there's, I believe, 16 delegates. And then we are currently in the Northern California region, which has something around 3,000 members. So it's about to grow because Stanford just joined us. But in any case, for the last few years, it's been somewhere in the realm of 3,000 members in the Northern California region. So we had three regional vice presidents. And I was one of those. And what a regional vice president does is partly attend to matters at the regional scale, but then also represent the region in our National Executive Committee, which makes key decisions throughout the year. Though the ultimate, the sort of supreme body in the democracy of CIR are the delegates who at the annual convention convene and are able to vote on really big picture things like constitutional amendments, because CIR has a constitution and bylaws and so forth, and can pass resolutions and so on. So yeah, that's kind of in a nutshell, the democratic structure of CIR and the positions and what it means to be a regional vice president.
Okay, yeah. So in a sense, every single person in the organization likely has the same voting power, but not necessarily the ability to represent themselves in the same way as someone who is a little higher up in the hierarchy.
Yeah, it's a representative democracy on a very like sort of human scale.
Okay.
In the US, we elect state representatives and your congressmen people and senators. And so anyway, it's something like that, except that we're much more accessible to the average member than something like on the scale of the US government. But same basic idea.
And then was that an elected role then that you had there?
Yes. Okay. That's right. These are all elected positions.
Gotcha. Moving on to like the general information about residency unions, just in a broad sense, why do you think we're seeing so many more residency programs push toward unionization currently?
It's a great question. I don't exactly know. There does seem to be a shift in sentiment in general, but particularly I think each year the people that enter residency or in med school are more interested in unionizing or more supportive of it, sort of have a understanding of what that is. I think some of that may be, for whatever reason, the fading away of anti-union sentiment in decades past that seems to be, for whatever reason, that discourse, which I think had some kernels of truth in it sometimes, but was also often quite misleading, that discourse seems to have lost its stranglehold on people's thoughts. I think, of course, a big element is just, this is just me speculating, but I think doctors of years past were looking forward to starting their lucrative private practices and so forth. And that's pretty uncommon these days. So I think we have a sense as physicians that, you know, it's not just put your head down for a few years and then everything is easy or it all gets resolved, but rather it kind of feels like there's going to continue to be issues moving forward. And this is getting really speculative on my part, but I have a feeling that it also has something to do with the fact that the future in general, it's hard to tell a story of. We all are aware of climate change. My own gut feeling is that that has something to do with making people feel like the thing that we need to do is come together to achieve things that are important to do.
Yeah, I could see there being a little bit of an existential element to it in that we don't necessarily have time to sit back and not have a seat at the table now. So let's work toward seeing better working conditions or better benefits or a better work-life balance or what have you, because you don't necessarily have the future that's promised.
I think there's something to that.
So I guess moving on from there, what are some reasons that residency programs should unionize? And then conversely, to try to stay on both sides of this, are there reasons that residency programs shouldn't unionize?
Sure. Kind of coming back to what I was saying before, fundamentally, to be in a union, to form a union means this is a way for us to, as you just said a moment ago, to have a seat at the table and to really, through that, be able to look out for one another and to be able to also look out for our patients. And, you know, I wish we lived in a world where we could trust that hospital administrators would really meaningfully look out for the best interests of residents and fellows and medical students and patients. And unfortunately, it's just very clearly not the world that we live in. And yeah, there's so many things we could talk about to illustrate this. It occurs to me to mention one thing on the patient side is a book I'd recommend is Luke Messick, who's a MD history PhD. He wrote a book called Your Money or Your Life. And, you know, it's describing medical debt and all the ways that hospitals have, over the past many decades, been selling the medical debt of patients for pennies on the dollar to debt collectors who then go after patients, with the end result of people being bankrupted and being taken to court and sometimes ending up incarcerated and so forth, this is a long way of getting to saying, like, these are not-for-profit hospitals who are engaging in this practice widely. Similarly, the same decision makers are not looking out for the best interests of residents and fellows. And so you can just look at the conditions of residency today. And also, similarly, you can look at the rates of burnout among post-training physicians, attendings, and, you know, see that the way things are running right now is not looking out for the well-being of residents, of physicians generally, of healthcare workers generally. And, you know, I want to be clear that I'm not saying that I think that the CEOs or the CMOs or whoever of these hospital systems have bad intent or are like individually bad or malicious people. And I don't doubt that to varying extents, they have actually good intentions. But these are systems in which their particular incentives or their task is to attend to the bottom line of their hospital. And at the end of the day, what becomes very clear, especially once you start negotiating as a union, it becomes very clear that we are a budget item to be minimized. And so, yeah, again, having a seat at the table allows us to have a chance to look out for ourselves and one another. Rather than, the alternative is just to trust that the hospitals will be benevolent and do that on our behalf. And it's just not what has happened.
Right. I can see how it's also healthcare systems and healthcare in general is just such a large machine that whether there are individuals in the machine that have good intentions, which obviously there are, doctors and nurses and even people in the C-suite probably have good intentions in what they're doing, but you are kind of at the will of the system and the machine. So that's how that kind of thing can happen. At least how I speculate it to be is that that's how that could happen.
Yeah, exactly.
So I know I'm not talking to someone at this point who has a negative viewpoint on any unions, but can you think of any reasons why a residency program wouldn't unionize?
Yeah, I want to qualify that I'm not a cheerleader in general. You can ask, you know, anybody who I went to residency with. I'm, you know, I wasn't someone who's like trying to recruit other people to my program necessarily, as opposed to just share with applicants exactly what I thought were the pros and cons of this. And it's just, there's a lot of things that get said about unions, in my experience, generally by people who don't have a lot of direct experience working within them. I certainly want to be clear that is CIR like a utopian, perfect institution? No, of course not. It's a large-scale human organization with all the sort of messiness, and it's a democratic institution. So it's not all some utopia. But that said, the key thing here is going back to what we were talking about before, it's democratic. And so there's an accountability there and there's processes to improve it. And at the end of the day, it's accountable to its members, which is a stark difference from the messy institutions of hospitals, which don't have accountability to residents in any meaningful way, particularly when residents and fellows aren't unionized. So that's one thing. Another thing to mention is that when I hear the reasons not to unionize expressed, I find them generally, as someone who is in a, so UCSF is currently in its sixth year of a collectively bargained contract. And at a place that's been unionized even for just 5 or 6 years, basically none of the concerns you'll hear expressed from places that aren't currently unionized, they aren't really legible. They don't represent what day-to-day life is like at a place with a union. So I guess my effort to try and come back around to your question and answer it slightly more concisely than I have so far is to say, no, I don't think there's ever a fundamental downside to having a seat at the table, to being able to represent ourselves. And yes, unions are contested and it's important actually for the health of a union, for its members to stay active and engaged and,
right,
and pushing for the things they think are important.
So what I've heard from people more on the anti-union side, or I think I read an article online too about unionization in residency programs. And I think the author was mentioning that they thought that we should take a pause on unionizing residencies because it was just kind of all moving quickly and there wasn't a lot of clarity in whether it's going to improve or whether it's going to reduce the work environment or that sort of thing. But I've heard some points like unionization will adversely affect residents' training, or it's going to adversely affect the relationship you have with your faculty. And in the same thing, I would speculate that these things are untrue, but have you come across any of that on your side of things, being at a program that was union?
Yeah. So what I would say is the program director thing comes up a lot, saying that, oh, if you have a union, it'll really hamstring your program director. They won't be able to do the things they think are good for you. And the reality is that we are, as members of a particular chapter that's negotiating a particular contract, determining together democratically. Usually the way this works is there'll be a bargaining team elected, and there's a lot of effort made to make that representative of as wide a range of specialties as possible. But in general, we're trying to create a contract that will be something that is beneficial to all of our members. It's fundamentally in our interest as a union to do so, because our strength comes from being unified, right? So we go to great lengths, even in departments where we don't have people representing them on the bargaining team, to make sure that their interests are represented. But also, basically, we would just never agree to a contract article that limited our well-being or set some broad blanket thing that says, you know, the hospital can't do this and this and this. One thing I will say is you'll see hospitals saying, oh, we can't do this because the union, but we're always pushing back and saying that's not what the contract says. That's not actually the way it is. In terms of, I meant to speak to the program director question. I think the good program directors are the ones who are looking out for the well-being of the trainees in their programs. And what's really great is when those people also have a clear understanding that at the end of the day, part of their role is to be a middle manager. So in other words, they are accountable to higher ups. And we've seen a lot of instances of program directors saying they're going to come out in support of something that we're doing, And then they end up walking that back because they're told by higher-ups that it's not okay for them to do that in their role. So again, I think that the really good program directors are the ones who recognize that the things that we can accomplish collectively together as a union are things that they can't accomplish in their role working, at least partly, as managers. And so in general, at UCSF, my sense was that program directors felt positively because we could improve our benefits, our pay, the list goes on. And so generally, the sense was that they liked this. To the extent that a program director wants to be competitive against other programs, the better the benefits and pay, the more competitive a given program becomes. And also, to the extent that they want us to be well, again, we can do this. They can't do this for us. They just don't have that kind of leverage.
I would think that an entire residency program full of burnt out residents is probably going to be, there may not be as much work going on. And so even to improve the conditions, both for the fact that you're going to have a group of working physicians who are going to be more excited and more willing to work, and then you've also got this program with better benefits that's going to draw more great physicians into the program, you'd think that there would be a good bit of support on that side. Plus, hopefully people in a higher position as an attending would want to see those who are still in training see better conditions than they were forced to train in, you know.
Right.
It's sort of that idea, let's just improve the conditions because I don't want you to go through the same thing that I had to go through because I know, you know, what that was like.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think there does end up being fear of the unknown. And I think it's worth underscoring that a lot of that fear is really amplified and driven by, there's a whole industry of union firms that fight unionization. And so at each of these locations where we've had newly organizing residents, whether it's Mass General or Northwestern and so on, actually at Northwestern, I don't think they hired such a firm, but at many of these institutions, they bring in these firms that have fought union campaigns in other places before, and they really try and spread this fear that unions are going to make everything really bureaucratic and difficult and so on and so forth. And it's just the reality in a place that's been unionized for a few years just looks nothing like what is described in these anti-union campaigns. But yeah, to your point about your average attending, I feel like there are some who hear that and it really kind of can stoke a fear of change or something. But
so the posters on the wall that say, here are the bad things that happen when you unionize, and the PowerPoint presentations that are sent out via email saying this is why you should vote against the union are not necessarily the truth when it actually occurs.
Yeah. As I said before, it's just not legible. It doesn't resonate at all from the experience of someone just living their day-to-day life in a unionized place. None of these things seem to be really empirically sound.
And then as far as like a legal standpoint, union busting, is it just a gray area where technically you could have a firm come in and post materials up trying to dissuade people from voting for the union or supporting the union, or is that not the case?
So I don't know to what extent, as I think about your question, I don't know to what extent union busting is a technical term. Mm-hmm. But what I can tell you for sure happens is that most of the hospitals or many of the hospitals where unions are forming do hire consultants, firms, whatever, to help them run campaigns to try to dissuade residents and fellows from organizing. And that includes a lot of what we call captive audience meetings, where the employer makes them sit through a PowerPoint presentation where they run through all the mostly mythical bad things that would happen if they were, in fact, to unionize.
But it does happen, and it sounds as though it happens fairly frequently when there's some organization going on.
Yeah, my impression is that it's more common than not.
Gotcha. So then a little background on myself. Before I started med school, I was a firefighter and a paramedic. And so in that role, there is a lot of unionization because a lot of public servants, whether that be fire or police, or they're all unionized. And so I haven't heard this in the context of medicine, but I've heard this in the context of when I was a firefighter, people who were generally against the union sometimes brought up union dues as another reason. Oh, you know, they're going to take a portion of our paycheck and who knows what they're using that for, and et cetera, et cetera. And so I could see how that could also be a concern to some people who are just not well informed on that. So what are union dues and how much do they cost, and what would they be used for in the context of a resident union?
So fundamentally, union dues are a small percentage of each paycheck that allows the union to function. I mentioned earlier the importance of staff organizers to help us be able to organize day to day at any given chapter. We have legal staff, we have people who do the actual negotiating of contracts. There's all this expertise that we're able to have as a union, but all of that requires money to make it happen. You know, another way to frame this is we're going up against hospital systems that are flush with cash. They have a lot of resources, a lot of money. And so the way that we can have a chance to win in our campaigns is we need this staff to do all kinds of different things. So dues are how we're able to do that. And there's a few ways to think about this. And most fundamentally, I would say this is what allows us to be unified through a union. So in CIR, the amount of the dues is, you know, I was mentioning democratic processes earlier. Dues are part of that democratic process. Members decide what the dues percentage should be. At CIR, it's 1.6%, mm-hmm. which, you know, if you do the math, that turns into something like $4 a day. So it's like a mediocre latte per day
right.
to pay your dues. And I mean, there's also one way people try and talk about this as well is just like simple math, which is to say, by virtue of being unionized, which again is what the dues make possible, so I went to med school at UCSF. I finished residency at UCSF. I did do my intern year in psychiatry actually at UCLA. And the year I arrived, I was there for the last 3 or 4 months of bargaining the contract for the academic year that I was already in. So when I started, we were on the old contracts, mm-hmm. salary and benefits and all that. When I started as an intern at UCLA in 2019, my salary was $57,000 per year. There was 2 weeks of parental leave. There was no fertility benefits. So I'm including a bunch of things. But if we're talking strictly about the economics of paying dues, interns at UCLA this coming year, I think are going to make like $89,000.
Wow.
My first year, they jumped from 57,000 up to, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but it jumped up something like $20,000, just like the moment we signed that first contract. From what it had been as of the year before. We'd been getting like 1-2% raises for a while. And then we negotiated, I forget the exact numbers, but it was like maybe 6% the first year, 4% the next year, 4% the year after that, something like that.
Wow.
So one point I'm trying to make is that the amount we pay in dues is a tiny fraction of the amount of salary increase that we get.
Okay.
So we do have the problem of freeloaders at times, but that said, we still have extremely strong membership at most of our chapters, though there's always room to improve that.
When you say that, you mean there are folks that are working at the institution, at the hospital system, part of the residency, who aren't part of the union, so don't pay the dues, but still are technically getting the benefit of the fact that you've, you know,
right.
negotiated a contract, et cetera.
The same conservative legal movement that has brought us Dobbs, more or less the same Supreme Court we have now, I think it was in 2018, you know, decided the Janus decision, which made it so that in public sector unions, there's a lot of technicalities here, but in public sector unions, mm-hmm. members are not required to pay dues,
right.
even though they benefit from the union negotiated contract. It's somewhat different in private sector employers. And I think something for us to develop as a field is to really, you know, I think people in medicine tend to be very sensitive to freeloading in the sense of like calling out sick last minute for a shift. Mm-hmm. Falsely or otherwise not doing your share of the work. And I think we need to learn to see this in similar terms, in terms of paying the small percentage to make it possible for us to, first of all, make much more than the dues cost, but also all these other really fundamental, important things at all kinds of different levels, from parental leave, fertility benefits. University of California, we now have $30,000 of fertility benefits, whereas before we had zero. We now have 8 weeks of parental leave, whereas a few years ago we had 2 weeks of parental leave. We now have, there's an arm of CIR that is called COPE, the Committee on Political Action, which is not, this is important to underscore, that is not funded by members' dues. That is funded entirely by additional donations that members can opt into making on a monthly basis.
Okay.
And that's also allowed us to get involved in, especially local and state politics, to a lesser extent more broadly, but particularly at these more local and state scales, we've been able to start fighting for things that would benefit patients. And that's something I think we could talk more about, is the ways that unions can not only try and make things better for ourselves, but also really advocate powerfully for our patients' well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's laws that we've been helping support and push forward that are towards that end, but also on the theme of dues. In California, we were able to prevent residents from getting cut out of a basically like COVID bonus program, which was much more than, you know, was like equivalent to many years of dues
yeah.
that we all got because we're organized and because we've developed this political arm.
It's a stark contrast to, I found one article published in JAMA in September 2021, and it was titled National Evaluation of the Association Between Resident Labor Union Participation and Surgical Resident Well-Being. It's by a group of surgeons from Northwestern, University of Washington, the Brigham, University of Nebraska, and essentially it compared unionized versus non-unionized residency programs, and the conclusion of it was there is, quote, no difference in job satisfaction, duty hour violations, mistreatment, educational environment, salary, or benefits, except that unionized programs more frequently offered 4 weeks instead of 2 to 3 weeks of vacation and more frequently offered housing stipends. And so obviously, like, my point here was housing stipends can be huge because the cost of housing can be so high in different areas of the US, but also, like, how do you respond to this article, especially after seeing the changes that you've seen? I mean, 2021, it's relatively recent. Are these changes more recent than 2021? Has this gotten better since that? Or how do you respond to this type of article?
Yeah, this article was very frustrating to read at the time.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with the article you're talking about, and I was frankly disappointed that JAMA published it just because I thought that it was bad science. One thing I recall from the article is that they found a pretty significant difference in, for instance, sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. Like, if you dig into their findings, sexual harassment was 25% lower at unionized programs. But they then sort of explain this away as saying, oh, maybe that's a confounder with that. It feels like the study seems to be designed and then beyond that interpreted in a way to drive towards this particular conclusion that unions don't make a difference, even though they're finding that it does make a difference in salary. It does make a difference in weeks of vacation. It does make a difference, as far as the study could actually say, it makes a difference in sexual harassment, which matters. And yet they seem to be driving at this conclusion. Also, yeah, it only looks at surgeons after they took a big test. So I would actually be interested in a study that really earnestly digs into what difference does it make to be unionized in terms of residents' well-being, burnout, et cetera. And it's not that I think that being unionized has resolved the issues that residents face, not at all. We are starting to try to address that. And as we grow and become stronger, I think we will collectively have more power to fundamentally change the structures of residency that are key drivers of burnout and everything that goes with that. So I guess to sum up, I don't think unions have solved everything. This study, I don't read it as a particularly good faith effort to understand where things are at. And I do think unions make an immediate impact in well-being. And I'll just add for myself that the sense of having agency is worth a lot. And there's other literature you could look at, you know, Michael Marmot's Whitehall studies and his subsequent work that suggest actually that a sense of empowerment is correlated with better health outcomes. Mm-hmm. So they looked at like British civil service workers and found that, you know, sort of at each step down the civil service ladder in ways that didn't necessarily correspond to like big jumps in salary or anything, there were worse health outcomes at each level. So there's an argument that's made that empowerment is very important for health in some very fundamental ways. And I feel like you can just feel that in basic ways, whether it's at UCSF, they told us that we were going to start paying for the privilege of parking on nights and weekends, whereas previously residents had not had to do that. I heard a rumor that this was due to a budget shortfall due to fewer people parking in parking garages during the pandemic. I don't know for sure that that's true. But in any case, we were told that we were going to have to start paying, whereas we'd never done that. We objected. They told us there's nothing we can do. And also nobody else gets a special treatment of getting free parking on nights and weekends, to which we said no one else gets a special treatment of working without extra pay on nights and weekends. But sure enough, this is not something that was in our contract yet at the time, though subsequently we've incorporated into our contract since then. But we organized, we used the organization we developed through the union and drove a petition with a large majority of House staff signing it and a lot of clear expressions of how people felt about it. And sure enough, UCSF found a way to not charge us for parking on nights and weekends, which at this particular workplace is a source of something that people are quite concerned about because we already are paying hundreds of dollars per month if you drive to work, which many people do because it's an expensive place to live. So people live outside of San Francisco, and especially if they have families and so on and so forth. Or another example would be our advocating for UCSF to develop a system that we can readily access for us to be able to get a safe ride home when we've worked a 28-hour shift or overnight in whatever way, and we deem ourselves not safe to drive home. Of course, there's good studies comparing how well you can drive after being up all night versus, you know, drinking whatever amount. And, you know, at some of our peer institutions, they've rolled out programs that through rideshare, Uber, whatever, that residents are able to readily use. The program at UCSF is one that residents have not found easy to access and have not been using in large numbers. So anyways, just to say, when you run into these sort of institutional barriers where you're told, well, this is just the way it is, there's recourse, there's a way you can move the needle on things big and small, that some of which are more important than others, but all of which contribute to this sense of, do I have to just take everything that comes my way, or do I have some say? Do I have a voice? Do we collectively have a voice?
Yeah. I mean, it gets me fired up just thinking about it.
What about what?
Just the idea that, like, my toes are dipped into this world now of feeling like you really don't have much power. And my interpretation of it is that, like, okay, well, I'm being eased into this as a med student where you're like paying a lot of money and like you can't actually change anything if you want to, because technically the institution doesn't really have to, because everyone wants a position in the class as a med student. So it feels like I'm dipping my toes into this, and like they're kind of, here you go, here's a little introduction into feeling like you have no power. So that when you get to residency and you really get, for lack of a better term, screwed, if you don't have that power as a collective organization like a residency union, then you just kind of are used to it already because you just experienced that for 4 years in med school or something, or it's just the way it is and you just write it off like that. And so the idea of making concrete change because of a group of individuals getting together who has a lot more power than people individually makes me really excited. And so to hear the things that have actually changed, it's an exciting prospect to see more programs organizing in this way, which I'm sure you feel very similarly.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So if I'm stepping outside of medicine and I put my layperson hat on and I see a lot of residency unions forming, one thing that I might be worried about as a layperson is, well, what happens if a bunch of residents strike and then the hospitals don't have staffing and patients aren't getting the care that they need because this group of union residents aren't working? That might be a concern that some people have in the public. And so how are these concerns alleviated? Like, are there clauses in residency union contracts that don't allow strikes? Or how would you alleviate that sort of concern in someone who's expressing that in the public?
Yeah, there's a few things that come to mind. You know, the first thing to say is strikes among house staff are exceedingly rare. And they're exceedingly rare, first and foremost, because it's a matter of last resort. We don't want to go on strike. I'm not aware of anybody putting in their personal statement as to why they, you know, are going to med school because they want to not work in the hospital. Okay, so this would be a bad strategy to put it in your med school application that you want to go on strike. My point is, like,
note for pre-meds.
Yeah, this is not what we're motivated for. So there's been only one such strike I'm aware of in recent decades. But the thing I think it's important to keep in mind here is that strikes don't happen because there are unions. Strikes happen because a deal isn't made. And my experience of bargaining as a resident is we are not making outrageous asks here. We are not asking to be paid the same as attendings. We are not asking for things that the hospital can't afford to do. So a strike happens when a deal isn't reached, and it's often because strikes happen because the hospitals we work for give us no choice. I mean, another way to think about it is you're just not going to get a group of doctors together to agree to a strike without a really good reason for doing so.
Right.
So that's one thing that I want to emphasize, is just the framing of, if strikes happen, think about the employer's role in that rather than the fact of having a union, which just allows us to, because from a patient safety standpoint, it's like, this is how we're addressing not being so miserable that we can't function, not being so exhausted that we can't function. There's also lots of patient care things that we address as a union, including advocating for more staff so that we can treat patients more quickly. In New York, they have a large patient care fund that, this is in the public sector there, where those hospitals often can't necessarily afford the most state-of-the-art medical equipment. So the CIR patient care fund ends up helping to fund better medical equipment for those hospitals. I think this is something we can build on even more in the future, is how do we as unionized residents really organize with communities and with patients to make their communities healthier and make their care better. But to come back to the question of strikes, the one other thing I wanted to mention is just that the way it works by law is we give the employer at least 10 days notice. So they have the chance to prepare accordingly to the extent that they're willing to pay for people to come in and do that work. Mm-hmm. So there's all these ways where I think at the end of the day, speaking as a patient, thinking about other patients, it's good for us to have unionized doctors, including house staff, and strikes are rare. And when they happen, it's usually because the employers have left us no choice and the employers have time to prepare and address that strike in advance.
I guess I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of strikes that occur, as you said, they don't occur very frequently, but at least in the context of even jumping over to nursing union strikes, I feel like those that I've heard of were generally surrounding patient safety issues, like poor nurse to patient ratios and things that would be dangerous in the first place. And so it's not like they're sitting there saying, we want you to start us at this amount of money and we want these better benefits. It's even just to the point of, hey, we'd like our ICUs to have 2-to-1 patient to nurse ratios instead of 4-to-1, or we'd like the safe ratios rather than coming at it through the lens of, we want this that's going to benefit us. It can be a safety thing.
That's right. You know, for healthcare providers, it's so much of our identity tends to be about taking care of our patients. So that is something that does tend to get people really fired up. The other thing, a lot of strikes are actually specifically about unfair labor practices. So the employer doing things that is not allowed according to labor law, mm-hmm. that is one of the causes over which you can strike. And oftentimes strikes are unfair labor practice strikes. So just to, you know, underscore that with the earlier point.
Absolutely. Well, Josh, I want to be respectful of your time. So I'm going to hit you with one more question. And it's just, if people who are listening to this felt like I did, very passionate or fired up about the idea of collective bargaining, how can current residents or even people that are entering residency soon, how can they get involved with the CIR or inquire about forming a union at their training program if this is something they're interested in?
So the particulars depend on the state you're in and whether you're in a public or private sector hospital. So given that, I can't give one blanket answer, but mm-hmm. what I would say is go to the CIR webpage, which is CIRSCIU.org, and there's a tab at the top that's labeled Join CIR. And then through that, you can schedule a call with CIR staff who can talk to you about the particulars of your workplace. I mean, but the deeper thing I would say is, whether or not you're in a place and a type of hospital that can unionize at this moment in time, you can still be part of organizing with your colleagues in various ways. So that's a necessary step to form a union anyhow. So talk to your colleagues, find out what issues they care about, and reach out to CIR staff and see what's possible in terms of formally organizing. And then the other thing I would say is, as I mentioned earlier, I'm interested in trying to support medical student organizing efforts at this point. So I welcome your medical student listeners to reach out to me directly. Mm-hmm. And so my email is jneff@cirseiu.org. I have a CIR email now that I'm staff. So
awesome.
Again, for residents and fellows, I would say go through the website. For medical students, feel free to reach out to me directly and we can talk about ways that you can, you know, you don't have to wait to be a resident to move this movement forward. There's a lot of things that medical students can do now, and we're just kind of figuring out what all those are at the moment. So I welcome your all's involvement in that.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Josh, for taking the time today. I really appreciate it. It's been a fantastic conversation. Great insight on residency unions and all the ins and outs of that, the benefits, the drawbacks. It sounds like mostly benefits, but I'm biased.
Yeah, I don't feel like I went in biased, but I don't feel, you know, whatever. Nobody thinks they're biased, I guess. I just have trouble seeing what the downside to us having a say is.
Yeah, I feel like there's always going to be more power in numbers. Medicine's a team sport anyway. Nobody can do it individually, so you might as well work together.
That's right.
So, that's my positive statement of the day. No more positivity. All right, well, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Griffin.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Medicus Podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to learn more about the Committee of Interns and Residents, you can find a link to the organization's website in the show notes. You can also find links to the book mentioned by Dr. Neff, Your Money or Your Life, by Luke Messick, and a PubMed link to the Whitehall 2 study that was also mentioned by Professor Sir Michael Marmot. I have also included a link to the article published in JAMA on residency unions, if you would like to question that article yourself. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe to Medicus wherever you get your podcasts. To support us, go to medicuspodcast.com, where you can find show notes, links, and information about our guests. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and X by searching at Medicus Podcast. And as always, this podcast is intended for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine. No patient-doctor relationship is formed, and the content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are my own and do not represent any specific organization. Thanks for listening. Until next time.